color. But before I get into that, I just want to tell you a little bit about my own frustration in terms, and when I talk to women, particularly African-American women, about the organizing right now. There's a feeling, and I know that we've all come together as women, it's a multiracial group, but there's a feeling with some of the women I work with that African-American women and women of color need to work, I'm trying to find the best words for it, but to sort of step outside of the multiracial groups, because there's a whole direction of energy around the discussions that sometimes have no relevant impact on what's happening in the lives of our communities. I'm looking at Gloria because in a couple of her books, I think that's pointed out clearly. I also think in some of the writings of Angela Davis, the contradictions of women of color being in a multiracial setting. And I just want to underscore that. I don't know if people got this yet or read this, just in terms of the State of Black America 1989 that comes out from the Urban League. I just want to give you a few quotes that sort of underscore what the sense of urgency is. You've heard some of it this morning, that half of the African-American children live in poverty, that African-American unemployment rate is 2.5 times that of whites. The thing that I find most interesting and sort of telling is that a couple years ago, in 1986, 696,000 African-Americans became poor or were added to the ranks of the poor, and 774,000 white Americans left the ranks of poverty. So that if you're looking at the conditions in our communities, we're becoming increasingly impoverished, and that has a lot to do with U.S. domestic policy. If you look at what's happening around the world in terms of the increasing impoverishment of women and children and men in Africa, Asia, and Latin America, and that's a relatively new phenomenon, you know, in the last couple of decades, there's a lot to do with the foreign policy of the U.S. and the foreign policy of Western countries. So what you're looking at, whether or not we all agree with the definitions of genocide or underdevelopment, what you're looking at is the increasing impoverishment and destruction of people of color. I think that this conference is focusing on public policy, and there'll be a lot of ways in which maybe we can find out what types of public policies will make a change in that. But to look at U.S. foreign policy then, and the role of U.S. policy in human rights violations of women, I kind of see it as in three levels, that racism is key in U.S. policy, that war and militarism is key, and that violence against women. We talked about rape this morning. You can look at rape as a political weapon against women, both in, I guess, in different levels. We're talking about the public and the private realm. There's other ways that I want to look at that. To start off with, if you look at U.S. culture, and I'm from a military family. My father was career military because it was the only job available. It was be a cook in the South for him or go back into the military. That's what he chose to do. So my understanding of living on bases and the whole mentality of the military, my whole interest in looking at that part of it stems from my own background. But that the U.S. spends about $1 billion a year on the Pentagon and on military-related things, that has a telling effect. But if you look at the ways in which, and Charlotte pointed out this morning, the absence of peace since post-World War II, 45 days, but Secretary of State, former Secretary of State Shultz, has also said that there have been over 200 interventions by the U.S. in the so-called Third World, and they've all been in the developing, I always put these words in quotes, developing third, whatever, but they've been in Africa, Asia, and Latin America to destroy people's liberation struggles, to install governments and regimes that oppress people. If you look at our focus of foreign policy, of military spending, you can see the ways in which the future is going to be exactly as the past has been. I say that because there's a bipartisan paper out called Discriminate Deterrence, which Kissinger, Clark, and Huntington, and other people authored. And these are Democrats and Republicans You can get it from Heritage Foundation for free. Freebies from them. But it basically lays out the foreign policy for Republican or Democratic administrations. It's a foreign policy based on militarism and military intervention, but only in the third world. Discriminative deterrence states that the idea of an East-West confrontation, which is a nuclear war, is not feasible. There's no survivability, no matter what, you know, Reagan might have said or put forth. And so therefore, U.S. foreign policy needs to look at winnable wars. And the winnable wars would be the wars that are fought in Africa, Asia, and Latin America, and the Caribbean too. What discriminative deterrence also talks about is a need to contain and undermine the independent struggles and movements of those people. Now, when you're talking about independent struggles and movements, obviously we're not just talking about men, we're talking about women as well that participate in them. I'm speeding through this a bit because I want to give us some time. Going from military intervention in terms of foreign intervention and looking at economic intervention, what we're looking at is austerity programs, austerity measures being put forth, not only in the developing world by the IMF policies, but also domestically, and we'll talk about austerity programs at home. But looking at the austerity or measures of the underdevelopment of the third world, if you look at UNICEF's report that just came out, which is its report on the state of the world's children, it basically states that about 900 million people are in poverty, and that's one-sixth of humanity. Not only are they in poverty, but they're going deeper into poverty. Those are mostly women and children. The increasing impoverishment, disease, and death occurs in Africa and Latin America, primarily, where the average incomes have declined 10 to 25% in the 1980s. And spending on health and education will reduce 50 to 25% respectively. Children bear the heaviest burden or brunt of this impoverishment. What UNICEF doesn't talk about, though, is the question of who created the debt and why. I don't know if I should give more background if I'm racing too much, but that the impoverishment is stemming from the fact that the countries have to gear their whole economies towards paying off the debt. So rather than growing food for your population, you grow what they call cash crops, CCC, which are export commodities like coffee, which you can't eat. Rather than growing corn or beans or rice, you grow cocoa or coffee or something that can be consumed by wealthier nations. That leads to a number of things. It leads to the destruction of the soil and the environment, which is one thing that was pointed out in terms of the ecology and ecofeminism. It leads to the lack of food resources for the people themselves. And it also leads to a mentality where the whole economy, domestic economy and the export economies are all geared to servicing other people's needs in other countries. So that what is at stake is no longer the needs of your own people, but the luxury consumption of people in other parts of the world, primarily in the West, in the US and in Europe. When the people who construct these bipartisan papers for US foreign policy, they see the situation, of course, as we do, the growing impoverishment of women and children, the increasing starvation and destruction of lives. But when they talk about austerity programs, they're telling people to tighten their belts. What they never talk about is the reduction of the military budget. That you can't dictate to other countries, that they should cut back on military buying, or they should cut back on developing their arms. And one thing you might want to look at, which I'm not going to go into now, is the whole weapons industry as an international corporation set up and how profitable that is. When people are told to tighten their belts, basically what they're told, women and children, is to somehow deal with less much less than they need for survival, much less than what they've had in previous decades. If you're to go from the austerity measures abroad and look at the ones here at home, from 1979 to 1984, and these figures deal mostly with women and people of color, the percentage of families headed by single women in poverty, living below the poverty line, which in 84 the figure was $10,609 for a family of four, increased from 34.9% to 38.4%, which was an additional 5 million women in poverty. A third of those, if I'm just weaving this all together, looking at, again, from the international to the domestic, and I've talked about underdevelopment internationally of people of color in the third world, military spending being directed for those countries to buy military oppression against those countries. But there's a whole discussion about not just foreign wars or foreign intervention, but also domestic wars, which ties directly into the increase of racist violence in the U.S. Historically, people know the history of the U.S. and it being founded on the destruction of indigenous people and enslavement of Africans. What is generally not talked about as much as could be is the rise in racist violence in the U.S. and how since the 60s the state has participated in that on a number of different levels. Has anybody seen Mississippi Burning?
Yes.
Has anybody written a letter about it? Or
yes.
Mississippi Burning is a retelling or definitely revising the history of the civil rights movement and making the leadership now white instead of African American, but also the leadership came from the FBI. And even though there's a lot of information out on the role of the FBI in sabotaging and undermining the movement, and also more information is coming out on the role of the FBI in the assassinations of African Americans with the COINTELPRO in the 70s, that popular culture still accepts and replays and promotes these myths. The Center for Law and Social Justice, which is located here in New York City in Brooklyn, recently released a report called Black Women Under Siege. And it talks about not the FBI this time, but about the police and the rise in racist violence against African American women, particularly about two women. One, Eleanor Bumpers, I guess people from New York remember Eleanor Bumpers, who was a 67-year-old African-American woman who was shot to death by the police when they were trying to evict her for non-payment of back rent. Sullivan, I think the man's name was acquitted on the murder charges. The other woman was Yvonne Smallwood, who I think it was a year or 2 years ago. She was with her companion, an African-American man, and he was double parked. The police began writing him a traffic ticket for that. And she told them, well, rather than doing that, why don't you go out and stop crime and arrest, you know, murderers, drug dealers, whatever. And then they proceeded to beat her to death and dragged her in a patrol car. And by the time she reached the police station, she was comatose and she died a while later. No one in the police department was ever convicted of that. What the Center for Law and Social Justice is saying, that these are not isolated cases, that if you're going to talk about violence by government agencies and officials against people of color, you have to talk about it within the states, within the U.S., and that the police and the FBI and other agencies as well have played that role historically, but it's a role that's increasing. What the center is concerned about is not just organized violence against women of color through agencies like the police, but also mob violence. The center has, in its report, and I would suggest you call them if you'd like to get a copy of the report, talks a little bit about the Tawana Brawley case and the kind of controversy and confusion that was generated around that case.
the most telling thing that they say, not to get into the specifics of the case, is that people, in looking at the sensationalism of that particular incident, fail to look at the what they have in the statistics of the increase of racist violence, which includes sexual violence against women of color. And so that when things make the headlines with the media, that you can get caught up in whatever sensationalism is provided at the time, but then you fail to look at the deeper systemic trends, which is an overall increase of women being victimized on the basis of race and gender for women of color. Now, what then is the response to that? If internationally and nationally there's a growing impoverishment or underdevelopment of people of color, if internationally and internationally there's an increase in violence against people of color, how do we respond? One way, and this is why I was really glad that, in fact, one of the reasons I came was that there was going to be a discussion on human rights this morning. People are looking at focusing on human rights treaties, which have been signed by the U.S. and which are sitting around in the Senate because the Senate doesn't want to ratify them and release them. But looking at those norms of international law as being our standards and a sort of a guideline for organizing. Because the focus on civil rights, which is, you know, identified a lot of times as civil liberties that was pointed out, is not far-reaching enough. It doesn't deal with our economic underdevelopment or impoverishment, and it doesn't deal with the systemic reality of violence that we face, particularly people of color face daily in a racist nation. There's a history in the African-American community of using human rights treaties for justice and for in liberation struggles of African-Americans. In 1951, the Civil Rights Congress was the first group in the world to bring the U.S. up on charges of human rights violations in the document called Recharge Genocide, which is out of print. But William Patterson and a number of people, in fact, there's about 30 or 40 people, women and men, signed the document, put it together. It focused a lot on lynching, but it also focused on the police. It focused on homelessness. It focused on unemployment discrimination in the workforce. Put together the document and brought it before the UN. The document did not get accepted in terms of being presented in the discussions that took place at that time in the assembly, but it was widely read. It was also an organizing tool within the African American community. Not only has the Civil Rights Congress done that, but of course in the 1960s, African Americans as well were organizing around the UN as a forum. In the 1970s, the National NCBL, National Conference of Black Lawyers, organized. And in the 1980s, in fact, in February, last February, about 6 weeks ago, African American men and women went to the UN for the hearings in Geneva. And a group called Freedom Now testified on the increase in racist violence against people of color in the U.S. and also the underdevelopment of people of color here. The U.S. delegation walked out during that testimony, returned, but had no response to give because the facts were there and the stats were there, and it was well received. The only dilemma then is how do you translate those experiences in an international community or forum to organizing here in the States, and how you make those connections and how you sustain them. One thing I want to end with is the view that in the changing notions of rights in terms of what we're entitled to and what we're guaranteed has a direct effect on the ways in which we struggle and what we ask for. And that if there is a focus on human rights and the focus is comprehensive, and that we talk about CEDAW, you know, the Convention for the Elimination of Discrimination Against Women, but that you also have to talk about the Treaty for the Prevention and Elimination of Genocide and Racial Discrimination, that if you can talk about the issues of racism as they affect women, sexism, and also classism, and that if you can make the connections between the international and the national in policy, but also in the rights that you're agitating for and advocating, that that will be probably a strategy for going forward. This is all very new, you know, so there's nothing in terms of organizing that people have put tightly in place together, but there is a feeling that this is probably one of the best strategies for changing policy in the U.S. Mm-hmm. Yeah?
What's the name of the paper you're going from?
My name's Joy James, and this isn't published, and this is something that I put together. But you can find, I would call the Center for Constitutional Rights and ask for the paper that Freedom Now presented to the United Nations in February. After I do some more work on it, yeah.
Could you also tell us what organizations you've been working with that are, that are pursuing this international work?
Right. I've worked, there's an international women's organization called Women's International Democratic Federation, which includes women in liberation struggles in South Africa, so the ANC women, SWAPO women, women in Eastern Europe in the socialist blocs, women in Western Europe, women throughout the world. They received testimony and presented testimony. I think this was the first time that they took testimony on U.S. women. And they got their testimony from their U.S. affiliate, which is Women for Racial and Economic Equality. But they've also given testimony on behalf of Chilean women and SWAPO and ANC women. Women for Racial and Economic Equality is located in New York City. They're located in Eastern Europe in Berlin. Their headquarters are there in Berlin. Well, I want to throw a question at you. How do you see organizing against racism as central to your work as women? And then how do you see doing that in a multiracial organization? Because where I'm coming from now, a lot of us are leaving them because it's just not, it's not viable, because I won't say completely, but a lot of times the energy is focused on our dynamics as we come together, and the issues of organizing around the things I was talking about, and National Urban League we're talking about, that they become secondary. So I'm just really interested in how people work together in a multiracial group and how you keep racism as central to your agenda as women.
Advisory board members to teach you if you're white.
it's a difficult dilemma when you're working on issues that, as we have in the past, that are very energy draining. Women and AIDS is right now, and the policy work on rape and domestic violence that have been very draining. And to some extent, the work we're doing on educational equity is extremely painful because we've gone so far forward and so far backwards in the last couple of decades. And the last 8 years have been especially painful. So what we try to do is not make the kinds of demands that we have seen made in other organizations that we try to say to white women who don't understand about other ethnic groups and other rich and sophisticated cultures, like the ones that were native to this country, for example, that you have to do your own homework. And also we try to do as much as we can with our colleagues and other organizations. But we feel like the way we are approaching the issues is what's important for us because we are a policy center. And that when we take an old issue and approach it from an unfortunately new perspective, that we're making a contribution that we can.
I guess I would add an element to what Leslie was describing and also responding to your question at your presentation. It seems to me that in the women's movement in the United States, that we still, I think, suffer from a tendency toward kind of single issue attitudes, which I think goes with what you were saying, Leslie, in the sense that we suffer toward thinking there's some single issue or single perspective that's the center of everything. And so I think that's one reason why it's very hard for people, for women here, for feminists, to really develop what I would call a multiracial agenda, which requires giving up the idea that there's any central experience of women, and instead replacing that with a struggle to see the diversity of women's experience as at the center. And I think it's very hard for people to really do that. I think there's still, in all kinds of different areas, but it certainly affects what you asked about the question of racism. There's still a tendency to think, well, there's some central experience which is defined by the dominant culture or some central issue to which everybody can be brought in rather than what are the multiplicity of forms on whatever issue you're working on that all have to be addressed. And in that sense, I feel that a multiracial agenda or a multiracial perspective, and I think your point is well taken, a multiracial agenda or multiracial perspective is something everybody should struggle for, whether they're in a multiracial group or not. And it seems to me that that's really the challenge, to look at why a group isn't multiracial in terms of what is its behavior and what is its agenda, rather than looking at who can we drag in to make us save or multiracial without necessarily changing the group. And I think, a lot of that depends on really starting to question whatever the work is, starting to question right from the beginning of the work, how has this been defined and by whom and what's left out of that, you know, definition of that work, and how do we have to broaden that and make it more complex in order to do any of the work we're doing.
Don't you think, Charlotte, that the
woman
has to ask that question has to come from where you locate yourself politically? Because I don't believe anymore that masses of white women are so naive that they don't know the meaning of difference or what have you. Because I think we live out the meaning of our differences in our daily lives. I think the real question that I thought what was moving about your talk this morning was that you emphasized so much political location and political commitment, as well it affirms my learning from Laura, how much women, I think, have to locate ourselves politically. And that doesn't mean, I think, for a lot of women, being pro-feminist is not the same
as being willing to assume a rigorous left politic that affects you in all areas of your life, a critique of capitalism, a willingness to see how gender and race oppression are linked to capitalism, and that we can't talk about gender equality under capitalism and assume that we are talking about the elimination of sexist domination and oppression or racism. And I guess what I'm thinking a lot about, certainly in terms of black women, why are there so few of us on the left? Why are so many of the black women visible in public life very conservative? And what are the forces in this culture that seem to militate against women taking rigorous political defining? I mean, just even to talk about violence against women, not as privatized heterosexual relationships, but as a systemic structure of domination that requires of us a political response.
I just want to say something. And then I'm not sharing, so like you could have jumped in and said something. But you know, like when you say there's not a lot of us on the left, are you talking about there's not a lot of us, say, you know, like the Socialist Scholars Conference is happening downtown now? Are you? I don't know what you mean by the left, because if we think of our politics, you know, as a whole, I find us much more progressive politically.
But not when it comes to being anti-capitalist. And I think that one of the central senses of being on the left for me is about being anti-capitalist, or at least about critique of capitalism and materialism as it is connected to colonization, imperialism, etc. And I think that's a weakness in the African-American political framework in our culture.
I think the women, we may not articulate the critique in the ways that it's articulated in maybe the dominant culture, but I think that working, I know everybody wants to get something, everybody needs some material level, you know, for survival and things, but I think, okay, look at our relationship to South Africa, right? If South Africa were to go socialist in order to have a free South Africa, that would not be a problem for African Americans. So I mean, implicit in that is a release of capitalism. I mean, because I think racism cuts us on such a level that our ties to capitalism are weakened, that we're not that strongly entrenched in it.
But see, I think our ideological commitment to capitalism is very strong. Whether we feel we can, as black communities. One of the things I've been very interested in is how black people are psychologized by popular culture to identify with the values of the ruling class, even though we may never be able to participate in that kind of capitalist framework. But I don't want
And I think also what I was talking about as well, the part that you sort of passed over of articulating a position.
Yes.
That articulating a political position. That process itself is not sufficient. I mean, I don't think it's sufficient anymore just to assume that black people are basically in sympathy with one another and being in an oppositional relationship to this culture, but it is important to take the step of articulating that position, which is why I asked you whether you have written a paper or whether or not you can publish, because it seems to me the weight of some of the things you said published is a different kind of thing. And it's accessible to more people. And then the statement itself becomes combined with who you are. And it's a different kind of representation of who black women are committed to society. It seems to me as important as the idea itself.
Can I follow up on this?
I think it's not a lot for Jackie. I don't think it's just, I think it's a problem for black feminists, it's a problem for white feminists. I am just astounded by the numbers of my students who think of themselves as very progressive and wanting change, and especially change around gender issues and homophobia and racism, who absolutely never thought about the structures of the society they're living in as children. And what's striking to me, back to your question, Joy, about what does one do and how does one proceed,
seed around working in frameworks, you know, that are multiracial or multicultural or not. I thought what Charlotte said this morning about a global perspective, and what you both, Laura and Joy, had reinforced in your international perspective in your remarks, is just critical. Coming into contact with people from the third world who cannot for one second of their lives not confront capitalism and imperialism. I mean, that's really an education. And I do believe that the experience of feminists who, you know, from Nairobi on, and who started to think about the conditions of women in an international context, that has changed their thinking about economic relations, about capitalism. And I think it's a process. I don't think just sort of telling people, you know, teaching them Marx or, you know, really does it in the same way as meeting people that you think are the same as you, and or think has something in common because they're women or because they're black, they're people of color, and finding out that your country, you know, is really implicated in the devastation of their lives in a certain way. I mean, this has something very moralistic, but I do think there's a process of change of consciousness that happens when people who have political concerns start to have international, you know, think in an international way.
May I say something, please? I feel one of the important things that has been said is that someone said it's not necessary to sit side by side, but it is essentially necessary that we listen to each other, not only with an outer attitude, but really trying to understand where we each come from and where we're headed. I came to this conference backwards. I spent my life as a trade unionist and only became a scholar in retirement. I've been a feminist all my life. My mother was a feminist. But the fact remains that in working in a factory where through a period of time the people I worked with changed from one ethnic group and one ethnic background to a multiracial, multi-ethnic group and background, and the effect that it had on the relationships among people, I learned a great deal. There was a time when I was the one woman who was on an executive board in a trade union. By the time I retired, more than half that executive board now had women, and most of them are of different racial and ethnic background than mine. And that they have learned a great deal. We have learned from each other. I think one of the great failures of the official feminist movement is that it has been elitist in its outlook, upper middle class in its aspirations, and ignored the fact that most women in this country and in other countries are working class. Many of them are below the poverty level, and we don't understand and think in their terms. I think Laura, in a way, expressed it because in Europe they're beginning to face the problem as a new problem. We have lived with this problem all my life, certainly all the years of this country. I think this young woman who spoke about the fact that we don't take a class attitude politically. And we talk about the Soviet Union, that they only had one political party, and now, great joy, they have multi-parties. We only have two. And they were not so easily distinguished when it comes to race issues. I don't see that much difference, only where individuals are concerned. So it's important that we start learning where we come from and why you have different aspirations, different interests, different needs than somebody else. And when we listen to each other, we may learn how to help each other. I was fascinated this morning about hearing about the Chilean women. I didn't know that. I've been watching what's been happening in Chile. I want to ask her now more information. I want to know a little bit more. It may help me and all of us to understand what's happening here. So I appeal to you, not only look at it as race, because race is a very paramount issue, but also look at it as she said, they looked for labor and they got people. We are all people as well as women. We are all people as well as whatever our class comes. And if we want to accomplish anything, we have to really listen to each other.
Thank you.
answering your question, I wanted to say something about the statement that preceded it, that a lot of African American women are feeling a need to get out of these multiracial stress-filled groups back to some single issue or focus group for African American groups. One of the things that seems to me to be most exciting about the women's movement now, in the last 5 or 10 years, is that it isn't a monolith control, and it was really, but that there has been a growth, a substantial growth, at the local and national levels of organizations and groups that are by, for, and about women of color, of different ethnic backgrounds, so that those, some of those organizations that we that continue to grow and strengthen are single ethnic group organizations, let's say. But the thing that's very special about this growth of organizations is that they're all connected to one another, so that you can be focused only on working in, as an activist with the Mexican American Women's National Association and building your local chapter, doing whatever it is. But you know you have a connection to a lot of other organizations that are working in their own communities and also at the national level, and that are also multi-ethnic, so that instead of having everybody have to join the same thing, you get to share with one another without debilitating yourself so much by not being able to focus on the issues that you need to.
Marion Chamberlain, on a somewhat related level, women, at least in this country, have located themselves on the more liberal side of the agenda. We all know about the gender gap in voting, and it's not as wide as I would have expected and hoped, but it certainly is women taking a stand for more interventions into the capitalist system as such, I think, in a more liberal agenda at the government level. I don't know to what extent that's true in Europe or other countries, the difference in voting patterns between men and women as against roles of government in mediating social problems.
Well, in some countries they've been able to find out, and that's mostly due to Scandinavian countries, for instance. I don't think that in other countries it's as easy to say, because of all these interconnections. Right now we don't really know about the Greens, which are new kind of organizations and locations and political spectrum. In Italy, for instance, women in the Communist Party, supposedly leftist, have gotten more power, more visibility, are getting elected, but then it's really not easy to say whether they are, you know, like in this discussion, I can't think of any direct involvement or not concern, but I mean the agenda is different. So I think that to some extent, I'd like to think about this when I go back. We have a heavy socialist heritage. We still think that the redefinition of the pattern of development is difficult to push through the left. Women are trying to do that. There's a general awareness of ecological problems, but it seems to me that the frame of mind is still very traditional. The other problem would be that the traditional women's issues seem to be very heavy, I mean, very central to our agenda. So this kind of much wider and more flexible way of organizing our own thoughts and projects is something I think is not yet part of our debate. It should be changed, might be. I very often wonder, why don't we have a European level anti-racist women's organization? If I thought of that, or if I tried to promote it, it seems to me at this point it would be very old-fashioned, so to speak. It would be women who started all over again discussing these poor immigrants' problems. So I don't think we have the... Now, what you have said this morning about human rights might help. In a way, I don't know, I always thought that the tradition of the socialist and communist parties was useful because women were somehow redefining this cultural and political heritage. At the same time, it is a hindrance, something that pushes us back and forth between feeling progressive and then having to come to terms with this already made sort of survival package. And we have to change all this. And it is, it seems to me, a very different path we have to follow from other countries, the United States for some reasons, and of course most of the other countries in the world for different reasons. And let me just say that I think that Europe in the coming years probably, I hope we have a sort of European context rather than the single country's context that we are used to, but might develop a specific pattern, which is different of course from other parts of the world, but it's a regional pattern, so to speak, being part of the world which is privileged and wealthy and in so many ways modern, but at the same time has to confront all sort of old models. And let me just say that the changes in Eastern Europe and in the Soviet Union for us, in a very different way from what this means for you, for instance, are going to make us rethink a number of our past beliefs. So it is a time of change.
I just wanted to add one thing, just in terms of about the response. What I find really interesting is when white women organize in white communities against racism. I also find it very rare. And so for me, I think one of the interesting responses, because I, right, there's kind of, not that there was an absence, but I definitely want to talk more about the class and organizing stuff. But the racial ideology is so intense here that, you know, it, to organize in the workforce or to organize around a lot of issues, it gets curtailed around the divisions because of racism. And people of color, it's not our role to go in the white communities and organize. And like Howard Beach and other places shows you, you know, just being there for different reasons, you know, some of the responses. But how white women organize against white racism with whites, I think that's more difficult than being in a multiracial setting. And I think in the struggle and choices about how you can respond against racism, sometimes it's easier to take what is generally a less threatening choice, which is to be in a multiracial group than to go out into white communities and knock on doors or something and just deal with it straight on and, you know, and struggle around those issues as white people. And unless that's done, I don't really see, because that's almost like first grade, you know, before you get onto any other level, unless you can really shake some of that ingrained indoctrination that, you know, everybody in the society. When I talk to some of my black women friends, we talk about internalized racism and working in our own communities for dealing with everything we've absorbed and all the negations that we've, you know, taken as truth in terms of racial mythology. What I find, though, is what I'd be very interested in hearing more about is how white women organize with white people around their own indoctrination system, and then how we could come together at different points and, you know, share notes or do coalition work, but still very much rooted around this struggle against racism in our own communities, dealing with our own mentalities and ideologies.
But I think, Joy, we have to emphasize multiple choices, because most black women who work in service positions in this culture have white women bosses. So the idea that we have this little separation, this neat little separation, and white women can go into their communities and work with white people, the fact is a lot of white women have power over black women in the workforce in daily life, and we need to begin to talk about what are the ways we can communicate with one another so that this domination is ends in psychologically, et cetera, et cetera. So that I think the time has come to stop
talking about one choice. I feel like I work within black communities, but I also feel like it's crucial for me to intervene in predominantly white male left communities, etc. And so I think we have to move away from a notion of single choices or single and talk about multiple choices, that we have to work on multiple fronts, and we have to educate on multiple fronts. Because first, I mean, I am still asking the question, where are white women to arrive at this critical consciousness that will enable them to go into these white communities and educate other white people, you know? I mean, somewhere, where does the blueprint begin?
Sure, I didn't mean to imply mono choices. Because the fact that we're all together, I think that's a given. We're going to, and the, like you said, the work situation, we work in white institutions, so we always encounter whites and we always interact with them. But the thing that I was interested in, because I hear it rarely discussed, is white women's organizing against racism in white spaces. Because I'm not there, obviously, if that's what they're doing, because that's a white space and I'm somewhere else. And so I would be interested in hearing more about that kind of organizing. I think, yeah, on different levels, and it's always a multi-level response, but that is one that I just don't have enough information on.
I don't understand why it is that you propose this kind of personal individualized solution to a problem.
No. Okay, I'm not being clear on how I'm communicating.
The problem that you propose, it seems to me almost racism is too small a word to describe the process of global social, economic, and political inequality, which you describe.
Yeah, okay.
And that to then somehow address it by sort of a one-to-one.
See, I'm not being clear then in my communication. I'm not advocating that at all.
I don't understand how it is one of people begin to address the structures that you propose outside of a multiracial.
Okay.
You said, I don't understand how you talk about it in multiracial.
Sure.
I don't understand how you talk about it in other than
a There's a group called...
Because we're talking about power.
Yeah, there's a group, okay, one, I'm not taking a liberal one-to-one anything.
Okay.
I'm talking about organizing in a collective...
I mean, that's not important.
Right.
Individual consciousness
is it important, an individual transformation?
About very large global,
yeah.
Economic and in terms of the violence against class.
Sure.
You know, in terms of the kinds of...
But let me, I want to just respond, because definitely I'm talking about structural violence, and there has to be a response that's structural too. But I'm saying that, the multiracial settings are important, but they're a given. That, you know, that's part of the realities that we're dealing with. I'm not talking about dismantling them. I'm saying that there's a sense of frustration with them, which is a reality, and then how we can deal with the frustration and go to another level is true. But it's still important that whites organize in white communities around racism, and that at different points, I mean, we're not always here together, so obviously we're doing work in our own communities. And what I'm interested in hearing is more about that kind of work. Does that make, is that?
Well, it is, yeah.
Okay, I just don't know about it, and that's what I'm saying.
Well, I want to make a partial response to that, but also to some of the other. There's so much going on. I want to respond.
Perhaps we can actually talk more formally at lunch, because time is really.
I mean, I think some of that work is going on, and we could talk about it, but one of the problems of that work, and so when I've been involved in it, and it comes back to really both what Michelle said and what Gloria said earlier about the relationship between the personal and the political, is what I find happens a lot of times in that work with white people about white racism. Is the real problem of the difficulty of people seeing these issues politically. And the tendency to think, and I see this around racism, sexism, and homophobia, all three, back to, I think, what Ross said, the tendency of people to think it's about being nice. And it's about learning to be tolerant and being good to individuals. And I'm not saying that that isn't valuable. I mean, as a lesbian, I want tolerance. I mean, I want some people being nicer too, but I think there's a sense sometimes in the individual work and in some of the groups that are done mostly around the ism, but not engaged with the ism in the world, which is what you also said earlier, that people get caught at that point, whether it's a multiracial group or a single white group. I've seen that. So to me, the struggle that I feel about this is how do we really connect the personal and political in a useful way. I think one of the problems with the left is that it wasn't personal. It denied the personal part. That's what a lot of us reacted to about the left. I think that's, but in the reaction to that, the women's movement often goes the other way, which is that it gets caught in the personal stuff only. And we forget that this is institutional political struggles, and we only try to become a less racist person, which is the focus of a lot of that work. Sometimes the connection of becoming a less racist person is to be political in the world against racism and its connections with sexism, but that gets lost. So, I mean, I think I'd love to have a longer discussion about how do we do this work that's very complex and not get caught. And so every single one of our insights, it seems to me, becomes a new trap if we get stuck there. We get caught on the personal and political being just personal, or we try to make personal stuff just political. And I feel that the real struggle about all this is in fact, that we do have to create new modes of work around it, that don't ever, when maybe we work on one thing at a time, but they don't ever become either or single issue mentality, so that we get into just that kind of thing where you think you've got the solution.
And, well, Ruth, I know we have to go, but I was thinking, for example, of the chemical dependency movement, and how, what competes, now that's a very new area of therapy. I mean, that is alcohol and drug addiction. But what people have done is they have gone to the workforce, and they are consultants who say, we want to come into this corporation or this factory or this what have you, and we want to do transformation work with people who work that you know to be drug addicts, what have you. Now, have we had that kind of systematic organizing about, we want to come into this corporation and we want to look at the interactions between workers of different ethnicities, and we want to talk about what kinds of programs people can go through, or what can people do to change both attitudes, behavior, which again links them. And I mean, I'm looking a lot at new programs that have intervened. I mean, the very fact that the chemical dependency called itself intervention, I mean, but they